KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in our opening hour this morning, Dr. Robert Lustig is waging a war on sugar. He calls sugar the culprit behind obesity, and he wants the government to regulate sugar the way it does alcohol. But his ideas have stirred up controversy among his medical colleagues who say he has insufficient evidence linking sugar to obesity. Dr. Lustig joins us to talk about his new book, Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease. He's professor of pediatrics in the Division of Endocrinology and director of the Weight Assessment for Teen and Child Health. That's the WATCH program at UCSF Medical Center, and joins us next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Bay Area-based physician and medical researcher Robert Lustig joins us in studio for this opening Forum Hour, a pediatric endocrinologist and director of the Weight Assessment for Teen and Child Health Programs at University of California, San Francisco's Children's Hospital. He put a video out back in 2009 called The Bitter Truth about the link between what he calls the toxicity of sugar and the epidemic of obesity. Over 3 million have now gone to that link, and Dr. Lustig has recently published a book called Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease. Joins us in studio for this Forum Hour. Welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael.
Good to have you back at Forum. Well, lots happened since we talked to you last. Not only the book has been published, but a nonprofit nutritional establishment is on its way, or enterprise, I should say, and congratulations for all that. And you're pursuing an advanced degree in public policy, in health policy. Let's get at the nub of
it's what you call being an overachiever.
Well, it's okay. You know, we're both overachievers, but in your case, there's a lot more attention, and it's attention that people feel is necessary and whose time has come. I want to talk just generally, so people don't necessarily know what you're about here, because on the face of it, a lot of sugar's poisoning the food supply, and for sugar's an addiction, and sugar needs to be regulated. A lot of people, particularly libertarian types, get their haunches up when they hear this kind of talk.
For sure. First of all, let me apologize to the audience. I caught the bug that's going around. My whole family's got it. Now I've got it, and I apologize.
Just
for
don't
my
give
voice.
It to your genial host. That's all.
Right. Yes, absolutely. That's why I'm sitting across the room from you, Michael. Look, the bottom line is, I don't want to have to be in everybody's kitchen. And that's what they're claiming. You know, keep Lustig, get out of my kitchen. There are several blogs, like on Lou Rockwell and what have you, libertarian blogs, saying, you know, Lustig's just gone too far. You know, look, the fact of the matter is, the food supply has already been changed. And I didn't do it. The food industry did it. It's been altered over the past 30 years with our tacit approval. We didn't ask for all of this extra sugar to be added, but it has been.
I think, as you point out in your book, it all started in the late 70s when they took fat out of the diet.
Exactly. Once fat was taken out of the diet, and it was taken out for very spurious reasons, the food industry said, well, how are we going to make this stuff palatable? How's anybody going to eat it? And so what they did was they substituted sugar for fat. Perfect example is the chocolate milk that the kids are drinking in the schools today. I mean, which was worse, the fat or the sugar? And I'll tell you, categorically, no ifs, ands, or buts, the sugar is way worse.
So they also remove fiber from many foods, too.
Absolutely. So they did that for shelf life because you can't freeze fiber. Fiber makes food go bad on the shelf. So the things they have done to the food supply are very specifically for them, adding sugar for palatability and sales, taking out the fiber for shelf life. And that's what the book is about, is to explain how our food supply has changed, even though we didn't ask for it to change.
Big villain here is high fructose corn syrup, though. I think people have to understand that, don't they?
Well, you know, the fact of the matter is high fructose corn syrup is only available in the United States, Canada, Japan, and very limited exposure in parts of Europe. But the entire world is suffering from this same pandemic of chronic metabolic disease that we have. The whole Pacific Rim, Australia, is right behind us, and they don't have high fructose corn syrup, but they do have sugar, and they are a sugar producer as well as a sugar consumer. Brazil doesn't have high fructose corn syrup, yet they are a consumer as well as a producer now that they've got a couple of dollars in their pocket. And Brazil has the highest increase in rate of type 2 diabetes prevalence in the entire world. So this is not just about high fructose corn syrup. The reason high fructose corn syrup is a problem is because it's cheap. And because it's cheap, it lowered prices on sugar the entire worldwide. And that let it start being put into everything. It started being put into hamburger buns. It started being put into hamburger meat. It started, you know, the barbecue sauce, the salad dressings. Bottom line is you can't find a processed food that doesn't have sugar. 80% of all of the items in the American grocery store are now laced with added sugar. And that is very specifically because the food industry wants it to.
Sugar is, in many instances, though, what could be categorized as a natural food. How are you going to regulate it? I mean, particularly regulate it when you compare it to addiction and things like booze and tobacco?
Well, actually, booze is very close. I mean, alcohol and fructose, the sweet part of sugar, actually are metabolized almost virtually identically in the body, and they do virtually the same thing to the reward center of the brain. So it's actually very akin to alcohol from a biochemical standpoint and also from a misuse and abuse standpoint. Also, socioeconomic status, lower SES people tend to be overusers.
And you say it alters our biochemistry, essentially.
Absolutely.
That's your argument. But it also readjusts our hormones. What does it do there? How does that work?
Right. So basically, because only the liver can metabolize the sweet part, the molecule called fructose, it causes liver fat to build up. We now have an epidemic of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease that is actually bigger than the obesity epidemic, because 33% of all adults in America currently have fatty liver. 45% of Latinos, 33% of Caucasians, 25% of African Americans. Considering that this phenomenon, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, hadn't even been diagnosed in anyone until 1980, the fact that one-third of all America has it right now, that is actually the biggest epidemic. How'd the liver fat get there? The answer? Sugar.
So, nothing else. In fact, in your book, you say it blocks leptin, which is kind of an energy hormone. I guess that's the change of hormones that you're talking about.
Right. But, and so it makes you eat more, because leptin is the starvation hormone. So when your brain doesn't see leptin, your brain thinks it's starving. Because of the way sugar is metabolized, it blocks you from being able to see your leptin. And that means your brain thinks you're starving. And so you overeat. So the food industry says, well, we're eating more of everything. Actually, that's not true. We're certainly not eating more fat. We're eating the same amount of fat. But boy, oh boy, are we eating more sugar.
Well, in fact, I was talking to Dan Zoll, our senior editor, before the program started, and he was saying, you know, if I have sugar or sweetener, it puts me to sleep. I mean, it takes mm-hmm. – but most people say they get a burst of energy when they have sugar. I mean, you hear this all the time, don't you?
Well, actually, the obese don't. The obese actually do go to sleep. Certainly, five-year-olds, when they get a cookie, you know, they're bouncing off walls. That's the sugar high. And so what – the reason for that is because their sympathetic nervous system is activated, and so that's fidgeting. And that's an attempt to actually try to burn off the energy that you just stored in an attempt to try to keep weight stable. But obese people, there's no sugar high. And that's one of the reasons why they keep gaining weight, is because there's no attempt to burn it off, because they're not seeing their leptin.
If you just joined us, we're talking to Dr. Robert Lustig, who has a new book out, and the book is called Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease. Fiber is an important part of the antidote to all this, as we kind of intimated. But talk about the difference, as you see, between real and processed foods.
Okay. Processed food is fiberless food. That's basically what it comes down to. Processed food means that you've got to take the fiber out for shelf life. And there are two kinds of fiber. There's soluble fiber, which is kind of the stuff that holds jelly together, the pectins and things like that. And then there's the insoluble fiber, the stringy stuff, like, you know, cellulose, like what you see in celery. You need both. What I describe in the book is like, it's kind of like the hair catcher on your bathtub drain. You have this plastic latticework with holes in it. So if you take a shower and the hair is coming down, it blocks up the holes, but only if the hair catcher is there. So imagine that the cellulose is the hair catcher, and imagine the hair is the soluble fiber blocking up the little holes. When they're both there, it forms a barrier on the inside of your intestine. And you can actually see it on electron microscopy, that it's a secondary barrier that reduces the rate of absorption of nutrients from the gut into the bloodstream. And what that does is that actually keeps the liver safe, because it reduces the rate at which the liver has to metabolize the stuff. And if you overload the liver, what it does is it has no choice but to turn extra energy into liver fat. And that's what drives this whole process, is the process of liver fat accumulation. And the thing that does that the worst is sugar, especially when it's not teamed up with fiber. We call that juice and soda.
What do you say to the argument, though, that in fact, sometimes I hear my mother's voice in all this saying, too much of anything is no good, you know, including sugar. I was reading something recently about somebody who's taking bok choy and eating a lot of bok choy because felt it could help regulate diabetes problems. And thyroid ran down because of stuff that's in bok choy. I mean, sugar may be toxic, but use sparingly, use...
Yeah, what I say is, look, I mean, sugar was always a treat. You know, in the Middle Ages, sugar was fetishized. You know, only kings got it. You know, they still to this day make, you know, grand sculptures out of sugar. You know, the king of kings of pastry is an example.
The guy who did the book on cod and did a book also on salt and sugar, you know, man, how they changed the whole nature of trade. And
absolutely. Dried salt cod, et cetera. Yeah, absolutely. So the thing is that sugar was always something to be valued and something that was a rarity. The fact of the matter is it's become anything but a rarity. It's in everything. We used to have sugar once a week, you know, for a nice dessert on a weekend. And now it's once a meal. And that is the big problem. Our current sugar consumption is 22 teaspoons per day on average for the entire for all of America. 22 teaspoons a day. The American Heart Association put out a scientific statement in 2009 recommending that we reduce that to 6 teaspoons a day for women and 9 teaspoons a day for men. That's a reduction by 2/3 to 3/4. Here's the problem. Let's say I could just snap my fingers and all of the sugared sweetened beverages on the entire face of the earth just disappeared.
Yeah, I think Mayor Bloomberg tried that, didn't he? Something along those
lines.
Well,
not quite. But what he's doing at least is at least in the right direction. It's a baby step, but it's at least in the right direction, and I'm supportive of it. But let's say we could just get rid of sugar beverages over the entire globe. That wouldn't do it because 1/3 of our sugar comes from sugar beverages. So if we're consuming 22 teaspoons a day, that's only 7 on average. 1/6 come from things that we identify as being sweet, like milk, desserts, ice cream, things like that. But that means that 1/2 of our sugar consumption is coming in foods that we didn't even know had it, like tomato sauce, like salad dressing, like barbecue sauce, et cetera, et cetera. And that is
there on the label,
just as bad.
Well, I mean, the amount of sugar is on the label in those cans.
Well, actually, yes, it is, but it's total sugars, not added sugars. So here's the question, and I actually wrote an op-ed in the San Francisco Chronicle 3 weeks ago about exactly this. It says total sugars. That could be glucose. That could be galactose, which is milk sugar. That could be fructose. That could be maltose, which is what's in beer. That could be lactose, again, milk sugar. And it can be sucrose. And it can be high fructose corn syrup. It could be the sugar that came with whatever the fruit was that the thing was made of. Like, for instance, in a pomegranate yogurt, it could be what came with the pomegranate, or it could be what they added. So let's talk about yogurt here as an example. That's a perfect example. How many, you know, yogurt's sour. It's sour milk. You know, the only reason we eat it is because we choose which bacteria it's going to sour. And that, and so... You know, most people think that, you know, yogurt's supposed to be sweet. You know, in Greece, what they do is they take the sour milk and they throw pieces of fruit in, you know, to sort of, you know.
To sweeten it.
To sweeten it, you know, to make it palatable. Here, you know, yogurt is sweet. I don't know if you saw the movie Parental Guidance, but there's this scene in it where the kid goes nuts and says, "You told me yogurt was like ice cream," you know, because it's sweet. And it's not. The point is that a lot of sugar has been added to that yogurt very specifically to get us to eat it. Because in America, yogurt is not sour. It is sweet. So how many grams in a pomegranate yogurt? 19 grams. 7 grams in a plain yogurt, 19 of pomegranate yogurt. That means that that yogurt is really a plain yogurt plus a bowl of Cap'n Crunch. Now, if you're okay with that, you know, good luck to you.
Well, that's, of course, the libertarian argument. That's the keep Lustig out of my kitchen. I'm okay buying supersized soda. Why should you care? I'm okay buying, even for my kids. Well, I mean, Richmond, they had this whole fight over soda tax, too. But if I want to buy soda with all that, what's the problem?
And if that was the only problem, I'd say, sure, fine, no problem. Go for it. But it's not the only problem, because what this means is $192 billion a year going down a rat hole taking care of chronic metabolic disease in this country. What this means is $2,750 extra on everybody's health care bill on their premiums per year that employers are paying. What this means is that there is no access and what this to health care, and what this means is that Medicare will be broke by the year 2024. So if you said to me, okay, libertarians, go do what you want. Go ahead, eat what you like, no problem. But when you get sick, you can't show up in my emergency room. Deal with it. You know, because if you're going to basically exhibit bad behavior and you expect me to underwrite and subsidize your bad behavior by paying for your medical health care services, then there's no problem. But that's not the way America operates. That's the way Russia operates. That's what they do with their alcoholism. The point is that we don't do that. And as you can't have it both ways. That's what it comes down to. You can't exhibit self-destructive behaviors and then expect everybody else to underwrite the costs.
So if somebody rides in a car, doesn't put on a seatbelt, gets in a crash, it would be the same principle.
Absolutely. Right? No difference.
So what about all these, alternative natural sweeteners? I mean, you know, honey and maple syrup and...
Well, honey, maple syrup, agave, basically they're the same. I mean, calorie for calorie, gram for gram, ounce for ounce, they're essentially the same. Actually, agave is even a little worse because it's actually got more fructose than glucose. Wherever there's fructose in nature, there's also glucose, and that's the problem. It's basically sugar. Now, honey and maple syrup and agave, they cost more. They have their own specific flavors, so people tend to use less of them, and that would be a good thing. But, you know, when you do it calorie for calorie, gram for gram, ounce for ounce, no difference.
Well, I got some more bad news for those who have a sweet tooth like I do or who love pasta. Pasta is not necessarily, part of that Mediterranean diet like many people
right.
are.
Well, pasta is glucose. Pasta is not fructose. Mm. Now, is glucose bad? Everybody asks me, you know, hey, you say glucose is okay because your body will make glucose even when you don't take it in. So if you are on a low-carb diet, if you're on an Atkins diet and you're not taking in any carbohydrate, your body will still make glucose because that's the energy that your body runs on. That will be made in your liver very specifically to keep the other cells in your body powered. Now, if you consume glucose, you will raise your insulin. And if you raise your insulin, you will drive energy into fat. And that can certainly cause weight gain. And so certainly refined carbohydrate without fiber can promote weight gain. I do not argue that. But that does not cause the liver fat. That does not cause the insulin resistance. That does not cause the chronic metabolic disease that we are seeing specifically with sugar. So are you, if you're saying, is glucose, is starch, is pasta, is rice, is bread, are potatoes, are they bad for you? Well, they're not good for you. But the sugar is way worse.
What do you say, and I know you've heard this time and again, Lustig's science is thin?
I hear this all the time. The question is, who am I hearing it from? I am hearing it from the food industry. That's what I'm hearing it from. You know, but the fact is, where is the mistake? You know, look, and I dare the entire audience to go out there and look for blogs out there where somebody says Lustig's science is thin. They don't say why it's thin. They don't say where it's thin. They don't say where the mistake is. In fact, do you think I would be sitting here right now with you, Michael, if the food industry actually had something to counter? They would be so all over me. They can't wait for me to stick my neck out so they can cut it off. They have already filed a FOIA request at UCSF to try to get my other support, my grant support. They're looking for ways to discredit me.
It's not only the food industry. I mean, you've taken on the FDA. You've taken on some pretty big behemoths.
Well, you know, the fact is that the FDA and the USDA...
USDA, are, you say, is a government arm of the food industry.
Absolutely.
But there are many parts of the USDA, aren't there?
But the fact is...
Many divisions, I mean.
Many divisions. But the fact is that the USDA's job is to sell food, you know? What do you think, what happened when that one downer cow went from Canada to Washington State 6 years ago? You know, it wasn't even our cow. That was the end of meat sales to Britain and South Korea for 2 years. So what do you think would happen if all of a sudden the USDA came out and said, you know, all that sugar we've been putting in the processed food and taking out the fiber for all this time, you know, it really isn't so good for you. You know, this is, you know, this is basically their own protection. They're protecting the food supply, and that includes protecting it from people like me. It's the fox in charge of the hen house.
There are those who would also say, well, Dr. Lustig, we can understand your concern about the obesity epidemic, about diabetes too, about all those things related to sugar in terms of toxicity, but breast cancer and prostate tumors and insulin receptors, come on, you know, you're going out on a limb here.
Okay. What we have on cancer and dementia right now is correlation. We do not have causation in humans, and I'm very clear on that. That's why I say it's not for sure. We have causation in animals. We know that these things cause cancer and promote cancer growth in animals. That's an across the board. You can ask Lou Cantley from Beth Israel, who's now at Mount Sinai, about that. He was the one who did the 60 Minutes piece with us back in April. So we have the data in animals, no ifs, ands, or buts, and we have the correlative data in humans. Now, causative data is tough to come by, as you can imagine. Those are hard studies to do, and I'm the first one to say that we do not have causative data, in part because everybody's exposed. There's nobody who's not exposed. So that means the baseline's pretty darn high. So it's very hard to see an effect, especially since we've only just realized that this is a problem. So this is going to take a while to get that data. Here's my issue. Medicare will be broke by 2024. You want to wait? This is not cool. Think of it this way. In 1972, we got rid of DDT because we knew that DDT was a problem. Remember Silent Spring, Rachel Carson? That was 1962. We got rid of DDT in 1972. But you know what? You can measure DDE, which is a metabolite of DDT, in the urine of pregnant women today. It's been gone for over 40 years, and you can measure it today. And the amount of DDE in pregnant women's urine predicts obesity in their offspring at 3 and 9 years.
Our guest,
are you okay with this? I'm not.
Our guest again is Dr. Robert Lustig. His book is Fat Chance. And let me invite those of you listening to join in the conversation here with any questions or comments you might have. You can call us now on our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls, and feel free to join us, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Again, that's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment. Here's David, who says, if sugar is terrible for you, why does fruit seem to have no ill health effect, and is the fruit and sugar absorbed more slowly, or is there just less of it?
Right. So wherever there's fructose in nature, there's way more fiber, except for honey, and that's guarded by bees. If you did a graph of the fructose content versus the fiber content of foods, it would be almost a straight line. The only thing that would be off the line is grapes. Those are little bags of sugar. But short of that, pretty much everything has way more fiber. Look at sugarcane, okay? The most sugar of any item in the entire world, and it's a stick. You know, you can't even chew the damn thing, it's so fibrous. So think of it that way. The point is that the fiber that comes with the natural fruit helps prepare, make that barrier in the intestine, and that reduces the rate of absorption. It also delivers more energy down the intestine. So here's an example, almonds. You consume 160 calories in almonds. How many of those calories do you absorb? Turns out 130. So where'd the other 30 go? They went down the intestine because of the fiber, and the bacteria in the intestine chewed up those other 30. You never got them. You have 100 trillion bacteria in your intestine. You only have 10 trillion cells in your body. They outnumber you 10 to 1. You know, they got to eat something. What do they eat? Well, they eat what you eat. The only question is, how much did they get before how much did you get? And the thing that makes them get it is the fiber.
Well, you can join us, and we invite you to do so. Again, the toll-free number is 866-733-6786. A number of other ways to join us online, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. Our guest is Dr. Robert Lustig, who is waging a war on sugar. He calls sugar the culprit behind obesity, and he wants the government to regulate sugar the way it does alcohol. But his ideas have stirred up controversy among medical colleagues who say he has insufficient evidence linking sugar to obesity. We heard him respond to that criticism, and we're talking with him about his new book, Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease. He's professor of pediatrics in the Division of Endocrinology and director of the Weight Assessment for Teen and Child Health. That's the WATCH program at the University of California, San Francisco. Go to calls here in a moment, but let me go to a few emails first. Eric writes, a few months ago, I heard on WNYC an interview that Dr. Lessig did with Alec Baldwin. Mm-hmm. Well, you're with a more handsome interlocutor now, right?
I have to say that I had such a good time with him. And I'm from Brooklyn. He's from Massapequa. We just, paisans.
That means Italian, where I come
from.
Yeah,
well, you know.
Paisanos, okay. And on that show, Eric writes, Dr. Lustig, you implied that eliminating pasta from your diet would help you lose weight. Is he saying that all pasta is bad for you, even when it is not highly processed or prepared without a high-calorie sauce? Please say it ain't so. Well, you have.
First of all, I want to correct something that you actually said, Michael, because everybody has intimated it, and I've never said it. Everyone says that I say sugar is the cause of obesity. It is a cause of obesity. It is not the cause. A paper just came out last week in British Medical Journal showing just how much of a cause it is. And it's a cause, and it's significant, but it's not the whole enchilada.
Sound like an odds maker here. 60%, 70%?
It's probably 30%.
30%. Okay, much lower.
Okay. Actually, Mozafarian at the Harvard School of Public Health looked at all the foodstuffs in the nurse's health study and the physician's study and said that actually potato chips and French fries were actually much, much worse than sugar-sweetened beverages were in terms of total weight gain. I have never said that sugar was the cause of obesity. What I've said is that sugar is the thing that takes obesity to metabolic syndrome. Here's the problem. Obesity, who cares? Obesity is just you're fat. Obesity just means you weigh more than you should. The problem is the chronic metabolic diseases that are associated with obesity, the diabetes, the hypertension, the lipid problems, the cardiovascular disease, and likely the cancer and dementia that also are associated. That's chronic metabolic dysfunction. And here's the problem, and here's the reason why all of your listeners need to get with the program. 20% of obese people have completely normal metabolic functioning. They will live a completely normal life. They will die at a completely normal age. They're just obese. Conversely, up to 40% of normal weight people have the same metabolic dysfunctions as the obese do. They're just not fat, and they think they're out of the woods, and they're not. There's a physician at University College London named Jimmy Bell, who actually MRIs people and quantitates the fat inside and out. And he's come up with a term he calls TOFI, T-O-F-I, thin on the outside, fat on the inside. And there are a whole bunch of people walking around right now who are completely normal weight and have the same metabolic dysfunctions because they have the same liver fat and they have the same visceral fat. They have the same muscle fat as do the obese. They're just not obese.
But there's felt. In many instances.
And they're svelte, and they think they're out of the woods. The point is, they have just as much of a problem. This is like HIV. You know, the fact of the matter is, when HIV first hit the scene back in the 80s, nobody cared. And everybody was actually very pejorative. And the reason was because only the gays and the addicts got it. But you know what? Then we found out normal people got it. And then all of a sudden, everything turned on that. When people recognize that you can have chronic metabolic dysfunction because of sugar, irrespective of your weight, then people are going to get on board. That's the important issue.
Well, it happened also with drug use.
I mean, absolutely.
When you think about it, with narcotic addiction.
Of course.
Let me go to our callers. And Lauren joins us first. Welcome.
Thank you, doctor. Thank you for your lifetime of work, and I want to thank KQED for bringing you on the show.
I think you're
doing a lot in educating the masses. My problem is the masses don't want to be educated. I'm the mother of a three-year-old,
yep.
And I made sure that until she was three that she stayed away from any kind of preservatives, additives, chemicals, and sugars. And my family, my in-laws, my sister-in-laws, many of them are teachers. Some of them are principals, and they say to me, you're neurotic. It's a childhood experience to have treats and sugar. My mother-in-law thinks it's her right as a grandmother to spoil my child with colorful, sugary sweets. And it's been a struggle because the focus is on me as a neurotic mother preventing my child from having treats. Now, I know that once in a while it's okay, but I don't want to have to, you know, give my family a reason why I don't want my three-year-old to have a cookie from Safeway with 30 ingredients I can't even pronounce. I mean, there's over 20,000 new chemicals, additives, preservatives out there on top of the sugar that never existed 20 years ago. And so when my 75-year-old mother-in-law says to me, look at me, I turned out fine, I say to her, the foods that you ate back then are not chemically the same as they are today than they were back then. And so I just feel so beat up as a mother trying to be healthy and keep my daughter, you know, healthy. I have friends whose children were diagnosed with autism, and UCSF has said, you know what? Change the diet, cut out McDonald's, cut out preservatives, cut out chemicals, lower the sugar. And they say, you know what, it's too disruptive to my family. We would have to change everybody's diet, so they refuse to do it.
Laura, let me jump in here. I want to get Dr. Lessig's response to what you've put out here. Yeah,
Laura, welcome to my world. This is exactly what we have to deal with. This is what we have to deal with in clinic every single day. When I treat an obese patient, I have to treat the parent as well. And I will tell you, there are a lot of sugar addicts out there, and they will, you know, when I confront them and when we talk about it, you know, they'll often admit to it. And I can't make any headway with any patient if I can't make any headway with the parent. And I can explain and I can talk and I can jump up and down. And the bottom line is, if a parent is not going to change what goes on in the house, yes, it's a major problem. And I do know that there is this, you know, shall we say, stealth you know, cupcake a conspiracy that goes on in schools, you know, baywide, nationwide, and, you know, and bake sales and everything else. And the bottom line is, you know, it's supposed to be a treat. And if it were once a week, it would be fine. But, it's once a meal.
But how much also has to do, and Lauren, thank you for your call, with the parents not perhaps willing to change their habits.
Absolutely. That's exactly what it is. So what we have is we have kids who are basically prevented from eating the cookies and the sodas that are in the refrigerator, and the parents say to the kid, those are mine, those are not yours, which only does more damage. The bottom line is the only patients that we are able to help are those where the whole family does it together because they are changing the environment. What the book talks about is the fact that you can't change behavior, but you can change the environment. And when you change the environment, good things happen.
Again, Dr. Robert Lustig's book is Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease. And our next caller, Bob, good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing today? Hey, Dr. Lustig, I was wondering if you could comment on the role of diet sodas and artificial sweeteners right. in obesity and diabetes. I keep hearing more and more that they're not the panacea that we thought they were. And right. also, I was wondering, why don't people just take more fiber with their meals in order to slow sugar absorption down?
Wait, Bob, just a perverse question. You asked how we were doing. Do you care?
Yes, I do.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Well, I got
didn't
the
give
flu.
Us a chance to respond, so I had to ask. Dr. Lustig, what about diet soda?
Very good questions, both. Let me do the first one first. Diet sweeteners. Everybody wants to know about diet sweeteners. And you know what? So do I. In the book, I say, you know, I'm agnostic on the question. And it's not because I don't know. It's because there's no data. And let me explain why there's no data. There are two things. There's one called pharmacokinetics, and there's another one called pharmacodynamics. Pharmacokinetics is what your body does to a drug. Pharmacodynamics is what a drug does to your body. They are not the same. We have all the pharmacokinetics for all the diet sweeteners because the FDA demands it. They won't release a sweetener onto the market unless they know all the different metabolites it can be turned to and that none of them are acutely poisonous. So we have pharmacokinetics. We have none of the pharmacodynamics, not one. And the reason is because the FDA doesn't demand it, so the food industry doesn't do it. It can't help their sales, so they don't bother. And the NIH says it's the food industry's job, so they don't pay for it. So at the moment, we have a dearth of information. We have no information to be able to go on. We don't know if diet sweeteners actually affect long-term food intake. Having said that, there are two studies out there in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition from last year that suggest that if you give somebody a diet soda instead of a sugared soda for a six-month period, you will get less weight gain than with the sugared soda. Now, that's not a slam dunk. That doesn't tell you that this is the right answer, but at least it suggests that you don't make up the calories in another form. We have way, you know, way further to go in terms of understanding this. And until we know it, I can't give a recommendation. Now, as to adding fiber to foods, here's the problem. You can only add soluble fiber to foods, so like psyllium and things like that. So when you look at like Fiber One bars, these are soluble fiber. And soluble fiber is not bad, but you need the combination of the two, the insoluble fiber and the soluble fiber. When you turn an orange into a smoothie, you have destroyed the insoluble fiber. You have sheared it to smithereens. You will now only have the soluble fiber. There's no latticework to be able to create that that barrier in the intestine. So adding fiber to foods only adds soluble fiber. It's not the answer.
Actually, I've got a listener here who wants to ask about smoothies and fiber. Now, if you go to most smoothie places, they'll ask you if you want them to put fiber in. But
that's not the answer either. No, how about eat the fruit?
Well, a listener writes, I've heard Dr. Leslie declare before and just heard it again on your program that fiber cannot be frozen. Is he suggesting that flash frozen vegetables such as broccoli and peas are devoid of the fiber present in fresh vegetables?
No, they still have the fiber. The problem is that if they're flash frozen and they are frozen like immediately in liquid nitrogen, you might be able to get away with it. The standard method for freezing, what happens is the ice crystals form within the cell wall of whatever it is that you're making, of whatever it is you're freezing, sorry. And when you thaw the next day, the ice crystals actually macerate the cell wall, allow all the water to rush in, and it turns it to mush. And the food industry knows that. But if you squeeze it and freeze it, now it lasts forever, and now it's a commodity. So oranges are not commodities, but orange juice is. Let me also address the other question about fiber. My colleague in the East Bay, Cindy Gershon, who is a chef and also now a food activist and now a food teacher, does this wonderful little experiment with her group at Mount Diablo High School. Takes two kids, gives one kid six oranges, gives the other kid six oranges, says to the first kid, here, make juice. Kid makes juice, gets a 12-ounce glass, drinks the whole glass, says, okay, what's for breakfast? Says to the other kid, here, eat the six oranges. By the time you get to orange number four, the kid throws up, says, I am going to die. I could not possibly eat another bite. What happened? The fiber happened. The fiber is self-limiting. The fiber brings the energy down the intestine. So number one, the bacteria get it. And also you get the satiety signal sooner because you are increasing the transit rate of food through the intestine because of that barrier. So you will not overeat. Nobody eats more than one orange in a sitting, and the fiber is the reason.
And we were talking about smoothies and fiber. And Flavia, you're right on target here, I think, aren't you?
Yeah. Hi.
Hi.
First of all, it's an honor to be on your show. And Dr. Lustig, I'm reading your book, The Fat Chance, and
thank you.
Question is exactly that. I do a lot of green smoothies for me and my husband, and I sweeten them with strawberries or bananas. And I just read in your book that this is the equivalent of eating fructose because you don't have the soluble fiber.
Well, you've destroyed the insoluble fiber. The soluble fiber is still there. But in order to make that lattice work inside your intestine, you need both. So I am not a big fan of smoothies. Now, there is this movie out there you've probably heard of called Fat, Sick, and Nearly Dead. And they, say juicing is the answer to everything. And I have seen this movie, and I am very, very unimpressed. But what can I tell you?
Do the same thing with greens? So it destroys the fiber of the greens as well?
Yeah, absolutely. It destroys fiber in every which way when you put it in a Vitamix. That's the point. Now, the good news about greens is they don't have a whole lot of sugar, as opposed to, say, a smoothie which has, all the oranges and everything else. Bottom line, how about eating your fruit or eating your vegetables instead of drinking them? I think that would be a whole lot smarter.
And thank you, Flavia, for the call.
The way God made them.
A lot of people asking if fatty liver disease is reversible.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely it is. So we actually just wrote a paper on dietary treatment of non-alcoholic steatohepatitis. Emily Perito is the first author. Luis Rodriguez, our dietitian. And the two items that cause non-alcoholic fatty liver disease are trans fats and sugar. Obviously, alcohol causes alcoholic fatty liver disease, but trans fats and sugar. So if you reduce your trans fat consumption, that will help. If you reduce your sugar consumption, that will help. And of course, if you reduce your total caloric consumption, that will help also. But specifically trans fats and sugar, yes.
A couple of listeners write really about what I would put under the generic category of concern about blowback. Let me just read you some examples of these. Rajiv writes, does Dr. Lessig fear that targeting a currently overused ingredient may spawn the overuse of a different processed ingredient that we'll be reeling from in 30 years? How can we mitigate the blowback from food manufacturers? And Steve writes, and this sort of dovetails, we have to have some pleasure in life, don't we? If we shut off sugar and fats, what unintended consequences will that have?
Okay, so two issues very related. Number one, I am very worried about the blowback. I am very worried about if we got rid of sugar, what would the food industry substitute this time? The fact is, this is what happened 30 years ago. We took fat out and we got sugar and things got way worse.
Or as someone who has diabetes too can tell you, some of the things that they substitute for sugar are far worse probably and even more toxic than the sugar. And
probably.
Certainly have a gastrointestinal effect on yours truly that is almost predictable.
Right. Absolutely. So my law professor, Marcia Cohen, gave me this candy bar. She said, try this. It's got all this, sugar alcohol. And so I had two pieces of it the other day, and I had more gas than I can possibly tell you about.
I'm being euphemistic about gastrointestinal, but that's one of the results, definitely.
And the reason is because since it doesn't get absorbed, the bacteria in your intestine love to make gas out of it. And so I was not very happy, but it was an interesting experience, and so I know it's true. Here's the problem.
So you can see there may be the blowback.
There'll be blowback, but that's because it's about processed food for them. What I'm saying is all food is inherently good. This is a very, shall we say, Alice Waters, Michael Pollan kind of argument. All food is inherently good. It's what we do to the food that's not okay. So in the op-ed in the Chronicle, for instance, 2 weeks ago, what I said is instead of telling us what's in the food, why don't you tell us what you added to the food and what you took away from the food? That would be much more useful in terms of people understanding what it is they're eating. I don't care about fat. I don't care about carbohydrate. What I care about is the addition of sugar and the removal of fiber because that's food processing.
Well, we asked our listeners on Facebook, should the government regulate sugar the way it does alcohol? And here are some of the responses. Mm-hmm. Edward writes, there's some things that can't be regulated. If someone wants to buy a bottle of soda or get a sugary snack, you can't stop them. Tyler says, most people are well aware of the harmful effects of overindulging in sugar, and whether we attempt to regulate it or not will not really hinder people from acquiring it if they want to. Steven says, people tend to consume what is put in front of them. If you walk into a mini mart and everything is filled with sugar, most people will buy what's there. Mm-hmm. Patty says, should they instead halt innumerable subsidies for farmers that flood the market with cheap corn and wheat, resulting in the presence of corn syrup and refined flour and most all American foods? Cut it at the source so we aren't forced to regulate it on the consumer end, or do both. Do something. The government is causing this epidemic. They need to be held accountable. And a couple of web comments. What about organic sugar? I'm a sugar addict, probably my one true addiction, and so are my kids. However, we're pretty fit, and hopefully it won't jinx us, but we hardly ever get sick. And when everyone is getting sick around us, even those sugar haters who say how it breaks down the immune system. Mm-hmm. Lenny says, I agree sugar is bad for 95% of people. What about endurance athletes, for those who exercise 8 to 12 hours a week and need a constant influx of calories? Is sugar okay? A high-intensity exercise counter the harmful effects. But I think Lance Armstrong had a sugar problem, too.
No. And actually, I don't even have a problem with Gatorade, for instance, for endurance athletes. I have no problem with that because what the science shows is that when you become glycogen depleted, so when the liver starch in your liver, that's there very specifically as your burst of energy when you're on the gridiron or when you're bicycling like that, when you deplete that and you take in a sugar-containing beverage, for instance, Gatorade, you will replete your glycogen faster than you will if you consume just glucose or starch. No question. And I agree with that. And if we limited Gatorade to the endurance athletes, to the middle linebackers, the 49ers, I would have no problem. The problem is who are they marketing the Gatorade to? They're marketing it to the fat kids. That's the problem. So if we actually left it for the group that it was originally designed for, when Robert Cade patented Gatorade back in 1965 at the University of Florida, and then the Florida Gators won the Sugar Bowl in 1972 against the Auburn Tigers.
Don't you hate that name, Sugar Bowl?
Excited about that, huh?
Don't you hate that name, Sugar Bowl?
Yeah, right. That back then, what was Gatorade? It was glucose, sodium, potassium, water. It was the same constitution of nutrients that we give cholera victims in India when they're losing water, and for the same reason, because it rehydrates you faster. Point is, it didn't taste very good. It tasted like tiger piss is what it tasted like. And the only people who would drink it were people on the gridiron. 1992, Quaker Oats was bought by Pepsi, and they said, how are we going to market this swill? Two ways. Michael Jordan, high fructose corn syrup. And they basically made it out like by adding the high fructose corn syrup, that was a good thing. And it wasn't.
Let me try to get Qual and join us. Hi.
Hi. Hi. You ran out of time. I'll make it quick. I went to my doctor. She told me I was pre-diabetic. It's not in my family. I'm not overweight. I swim. I walk my dog. I was shocked. I couldn't believe it. I went to a local health food store down in Redwood City and talked to the owner. I was going for vitamins. Just happened to mention to him my lab results. So he talked to me. He told me everything this doctor is saying. He said to make it easy, cut out three things. Cut out sugar additives, and that would include honey and agave and those things as well. Raw sugar, organic sugar. Cut out grains and cut out fruit juice.
There you go.
And he said, you don't have to do it cold turkey. Anything you do will make a difference. Mm-hmm. So I did it as best as I could. I didn't cut out everything. I love pasta, but I cut back on it. Cut back on everything. I did cut out the bread that I liked. I went for blood work about 3 months later, and my doctor looked at me and said, you're no longer pre-diabetic.
Yeah, you can control it with food, and I can attest to that.
There's no question. Alec Baldwin did.
Your doctor gave you good advice. I just wanted to mention the fact that we're going to a quick break here, and I need to do that. I need to remind listeners that the way to support this radio station is, of course, going to kqed.org. And this is a fundraising period. So for more information about how to support us, as I said, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. Bob Lustig, you were saying. Sorry.
Well, what I was saying is that I understand that regulation of sugar is a very difficult issue for the American public. It is everywhere. It is ubiquitous. It is a nutrient. It is natural. But you know what? So are cocaine, nicotine, amphetamine, cannabis, ethanol, heroin. You know, the bottom line is, if something is both toxic and abused, we regulate it. And that is what we now find, that sugar, based on its hepatic signature and its effect on the brain, is. And until we figure out ways to be able to limit total availability, and we can do it in very unique and interesting ways. For instance, how about we have a blue law period from, say, 7 to 9 in the morning, where kids walking to school can't buy sodas, and 3 to 5 p.m. where kids can't buy sodas, and then they can, you know, the rest of the time. How about if a parent wants a kid to have a soda, let them buy it for him? There are ways to do it so that if people really want to do it, they can do it.
That's self-regulation, though. That's not governmental regulation.
Well, no, that would be governmental regulation. There would be ordinances that would...
Oh, I thought you were suggesting that that parents really have to monitor, too.
Well, the problem is,
we're not going to buy you any treats from 7 to 9.
Well, the problem is the kid has the money in their pocket. My colleague Chris Madsen at UCSF and UC Berkeley did a study looking at whether kids walked to school and whether their BMI was lower if they did. And it turned out the kids who walked to school, their BMI was higher. Not lower, it was higher. And the reason it was higher was because they were stopping at the convenience store, either to school or on the way home from school. And what do you think they were getting?
We'll get another caller on. Maria, hi.
Hi. Dr. Lustig, I just want to ask you your opinion on... I have multiple sclerosis, and it's so severe, and I think it's because of all the sugar that I ate as a kid, but of course, anyone I ask, my neurologist or whatever, when I mention it, they kind of think I'm crazy. And I just want your two cents on that.
There are no – first of all, I'm very sorry about your MS. I understand completely. There are no studies that equate sugar consumption with multiple sclerosis as of now. That doesn't mean it's not true. It just means that there are no studies that say that that's the case. Now, having said that, I have a very good friend whose physician has told her that she should be eating a very low-fat diet. Less than 10 grams of saturated fat per day. And she's been able to stave off the effects of her multiple sclerosis for many years by having done that. I'm not sure I even understand why that works, but nonetheless, it has worked for her. I am not a neurologist. I don't take care of MS. So, you know, you have to take anything I say on this subject with a grain of salt. But I can't specifically categorically state that your sugar consumption has anything to do with your MS.
Well, good luck to you. And Maria, thank you for the call. Looking at a listener who says, my daughter was an infant. I noticed that most infant formulas are fructose-based. Not sure it was better, but I chose a glucose-based formula.
Yeah.
How much is formula affecting obesity?
Oh, I think it's a big issue. For instance, and I give this talk, Isomil, which is a lactose-free formula, it is 10.3% sucrose, while Coca-Cola is 10.5% sucrose. Bottom line is it's a baby milkshake.
Can I get a quick call on with you, Donna? We've barely got time, please. We got seconds, yeah.
I have a lot of knowledge in nutrition, didn't grow up with sugar, healthy environment. How come I can't kick it? I have a BS in exercise physiology. It's like heroin.
All right, how do you kick sugar? There you
how
go.
Do you? I wish I knew.
That'll be the next book.
Well, maybe it will. The fact is that this is addictive. It is weakly addictive, but because it's everywhere, you can't get away from
it. Well, that ubiquitousness will be the final word. Thank you, Bob Lustig.
Thank
Robert
you,
Lustig's
Michael.
Book is Fat Chance, and Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.